Thank you for downloading this podcast from the UK Intensive Care Society State of the Art Meeting 2015. It's even better in person, so put December the 5th to the 7th, 2016 in your diary and come and join us in London next year.
Okay, so our last speaker in this session is Dan, who has the invidious position of being an intensive care consultant in the Royal Free with adjacencies to our sort of UK infectious control unit that was used for Ebola. So he's going to talk a little bit about that relationship and try and just draw a conclusion as to what we've learned that we might need to consider putting in place next time, really.
Thanks very much, and good morning. My name's Dan Martin, and I'm the critical care lead for the high-level isolation unit at the Royal Free Hospital in London, which is the designated UK site for treating patients with viral hemorrhagic fever. And I was given this title by the organisers, which is a little bit challenging because, as I'm sure you are familiar with, the health safety executive algorithm, which, don't worry about the fact that you can't see the words here, for managing patients with suspected or confirmed viral hemorrhagic fever. They sort of go through the various ways in which you should isolate the patient and protect your staff, but when it comes down to it, when you have made your positive diagnosis of viral hemorrhagic fever, all you need to do is call the Royal Free and transfer the patient and your problem is over. So I thought, like the previous two speakers, I'd give you a bit of a run through of what it is that happens when your patient then arrives at the Royal Free Hospital. And it sort of complements their talks because we manage these patients in a very different way from both of the speakers who previously have spoken about approach the situation. Before I do that, though, what I'd like to do, just share with you an article from the Times that was published in August of 2014, just to try and demonstrate to you what we were dealing with at the time. And this article was basically when Will Pooley, our first patient, was admitted to the hospital. And what it said within it was that with no proven treatment for Ebola, care will be limited to fairly basic supportive treatment. The article then went on to say that the key skill of staff at the high-level isolation unit at the Royal Free Hospital in North London was knowing how to treat a patient through a plastic bag whilst minimising their own infection. And whilst I don't disagree that these are important skills of the unit, I hope that by the end of this talk you will see that there's a little bit more that we can offer to our patients than simply the plastic bag approach. And to kind of summarise at the beginning and just rapidly run through what I think it is that we can offer our patients, which is a fairly unique service in this country. Overall, we have about 40 years' worth of accumulated experience treating patients with viral hemorrhagic fevers through Lassa fever, Crimean Congo, and Ebola virus disease. The system which we use, which I'll spend a bit of time walking you through, if you like, is called a Trexler isolator, and it's a phenomenal biocontainment unit, but is not really used anywhere else in the world. We have absolutely excellent specialist nursing capability from both our ID nurses and our critical care nurses, and this is one of the keys to the safe management of our patients who are admitted to the hospital. We have a truly multidisciplinary team approach, and I know that we all think that we work in multidisciplinary teams in intensive care, but it doesn't really feel that often in the intensive care that I work in, certainly. But up here, up in the isolation unit, and I'll kind of run through how a normal day looks for you, it really is a true multidisciplinary team. We're able to provide critical care support in a different way to the previous speaker has outlined, and I'll show you a bit about that. And we also, being a resource-rich environment, have access to and great experience now with a whole range of experimental therapies, which I shall just quickly tell you about a bit later. We've also had 100% success in the four patients that we treated over the last 18 months, and we have infected no healthcare workers, which I think is a sort of testament to the whole system that we have there. So what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to talk about the individual patients themselves. And the reason for that is because the patients are have been in the media, and there's a very sort of high profile media attachment to them. So you will know who all our patients are, and for that reason I'm not going to go into their details. Will Pooley was the first patient we admitted in August of 2014, followed by Pauline Kafferke here over the sort of New Year period of the same year, then Anna Cross in the spring of 2014, and then more recently, as I'm sure you've all seen in the press, Pauline Kafferke was readmitted to the Royal Free Hospital. It was the first ever case of reactivated Ebola virus disease 9 months after she was given the all clear. In the background to that, what we've also been doing is managing patients with needle stick injuries. I hasten to add that none of these were our healthcare workers. There are a series of healthcare workers evacuated back from Sierra Leone and treated in the hospital using an algorithm that we came up with to categorise them into a risk stratification and then treat them with the experimental therapies that we had to hand, and none of those patients converted to Ebola virus disease after some extremely high-risk injuries that we observed. Just to show you a bit of the history of why it is that the UK's containment centre is in the most highly densely populated place in the country, this hospital here was opened in 1887. It's Coppet's Wood Hospital in North London. And it was opened as an infectious diseases hospital. In 1963, the Royal Free was affiliated to it and added greatly to the infectious diseases activity that occurred there. But like most of these great hospitals, this is what the Coppet's Wood Hospital currently looks like. But before it went to rack and ruin in 1973, the British government became very concerned about highly contagious diseases. The disease they were worried about then, though, was smallpox. They were worried that smallpox might come back, and what would we do if we had a patient with smallpox in a British hospital? So the High Security Infectious Diseases Unit was built, and this is an old picture of the unit in Coppet's Wood Hospital in the 1980s before the unit was shut down. No sooner had it opened, though, that we never actually managed to admit a patient with smallpox, but in 1976 a patient was admitted with Ebola virus disease. He was a scientist working in Porton Down Laboratory who got a needle stick injury. He had a positive diagnosis confirmed of Ebola virus disease with viral culture. He was transferred to Coppet's Wood Hospital, put into the Trexler isolator system, treated with convalescent plasma and antiviral therapy, and made a good recovery. So not very much different to what we're doing today. And the important thing about this case is that in that Trexler environment system, not a single healthcare worker was infected, and over 25 nurses were involved in the care of this patient. As time went on, we continued to treat patients in this unit. The patient here in this newspaper article in 2000 had Lassa fever, quite a high-profile case. This is the patient being treated in the Coppet's Wood unit before it was moved into the Royal Free Hospital. The observant amongst you will notice that the patient is intubated and being ventilated. Very unwell patient with Lassa fever. The facilities at Coppet's Wood Hospital was not as good as we have currently. Here you can see an old ventilator attached to the patient with tubing sort of taped as it goes through the wall of the tent to the patient. One thing that hadn't been really thought out in advance is that Coppet's Wood Hospital doesn't have any oxygen supply to it, so all of the oxygen was provided by cylinders. We've also treated patients with Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, and as you can see for the headline, not a very good outcome for that patient, unfortunately. So I'm just going to take you through now what the unit looks like, how we manage patients in this sort of environment. So this is the arrival of Anna Cross. Thanks to this big media coverage, we have the Sky news helicopter usually floating around above our hospital, which creates great photographs for talks. This is Anna in the patient transport isolator, which is that would have been loaded onto an aircraft in Sierra Leone, transferred across to the UK, and brought to the back of our hospital with a well-rehearsed drill of getting the patient into the hospital in a very contained way. The yellow bins here are all the waste produced during the transfer, which have to be brought to our unit and then dealt with in the appropriate manner. This is the patient transport isolator. This is a very old one that we rarely use anymore. This is the more modern one. And this big round circle here is designed to interlock with our Trexler isolator system so that the patient can be easily moved from the transport isolator into the Trexler system where they will be managed in the unit. The unit, like the unit in Germany, is completely purpose-built for looking after patients with highly infectious diseases. The area that it takes up is the size of a normal ward. So in our hospital, this is where we would normally treat 32 patients, and this is designed simply to treat two patients. We have two isolator rooms here and here, each with a Trexler system in them. And basically, this unit then acts as a hospital within a hospital to look after the patient. We have changing facilities. It has its own air system, a filter system to put air back out into the community again, a laboratory to do all the testing in, and I'll quickly walk you through those. So this is the Trexler isolator that we manage all our patients with viral hemorrhagic fever in. You see it's a metal frame with a plastic tent hung from that metal frame with these half suits built into the wall. And it's these half suits that give it its safety because all of the badness is inside the tent, and as a member of staff coming to treat a patient, you get into the half suit, manage the patient, and then come away from it. You do not have the complications of training people that you've seen in the last two talks for PPE. We do not use PPE at all in the management of our patients in this setup. You simply have to get into the half suit and back out again during their management. What it does mean is it's a bit more of a confined area to provide care in, particularly critical care. From here again, you can see the sides of the suits to get into and these sort of sleeves that you can also insert your arms into if you don't want to get into an entire suit, if you're just doing something quickly with a patient. At the foot end of the bed here is this sort of Heath Robinson type contraption, but this allows you to get items into and out of the Trexler isolator safely through these ports here where items are basically wrapped in plastic bags and passed in and again wrapped and sealed in bags to come out again. This is what it's like to be inside the tent. This is one of our nurses, just sort of showing you, although it can be a little bit claustrophobic once you've got into the suit and are in there with the patient, you do actually get quite a lot of movement and flexibility when you're in there. And this, of course, is the important place, the head end, which we now, in the old previous tents in Coppets Wood, there was no head end suit. That the patient that you saw in Lassa fever had to be intubated from one of the side suits, which was a little bit challenging. And this is actually one of our simulations where we train staff who go up to the unit to go through the procedures necessary, as you saw in previous talks, putting in central venous access and intubating patients in this environment. We have a level 3 plus contamination laboratory where we have all of our own point of care testing available within the unit. The blood that we analyse clearly has Ebola virus in it, so that blood is not permitted to leave the unit to go to any of the laboratories in the hospital. The only other place it can go to is one of the reference laboratories for looking at viral load. And viral load we don't test here. At the bottom of the list, you can see thromboelastography, something that we've recently introduced to the point of care testing laboratory, which has really improved our ability to monitor coagulation in these patients with hemorrhagic fevers. So I said it was a truly multidisciplinary team, and I just show you here the main groups of people who are involved on a daily basis looking after these patients. We have 12 hourly meetings in the unit to discuss the patient in detail. We go through absolutely every blood testing, clinical finding. The meetings usually take about half an hour to an hour. And in those meetings, we draw up a clear plan for the next 12 hours of managing the patient so everybody in the team knows exactly what's going on. The basic supportive care that was mentioned in the Times article is effective in reducing mortality in these patients and is really the key to getting things right. If you can get this right, it gives you the opportunity to introduce other things which may or may not be of benefit to the patient, which we'll come on to. And I think we've been through in detail already the sorts of things that these patients require due to the underlying illness that they have. The part that's a little bit different perhaps for us at the Royal Free is access to drugs like these. And we've used all of these drugs on the various different patients that we've had and during the Ebola outbreak. And in particular, ZMAB, which is different from ZMAP, is a precursor to ZMAP, and MIL-77, another monoclonal antibody. These were both first-in-man drugs, so they'd never been given to a human being before, which produces quite a challenge when going through the regulatory authorities to give what is not even a drug, but just an experimental compound to a patient in your hospital. And similarly with GS-5734, which we used recently, which is a highly potent antiviral drug, had only been given to a dozen healthy volunteers and never used against Ebola virus disease. But, as I said here, we have absolutely no idea whether these therapies work, so you mustn't rely on them as the mainstay of your treatment. This is the sort of setup. Once we've elevated things to a critical care level with the patients in the isolation unit, we have a dedicated ICU consultant available with anaesthetic skills 24 hours a day. We will have two ICU nurses and two ID nurses looking after the patients. That's a 4-to-1 ratio looking after the patient. So this is very costly from a staffing perspective, but all of this it has to go on without having any other impact on the rest of how our hospital works. So it's all resourced completely externally to the way that the rest of the hospital is functioning. Here you see, in common with the other groups around the world, one of the first things we do when a patient arrives is to put a central venous catheter in, firstly to allow us to resuscitate from a fluid and electrolyte perspective, but also secondly for safety, to prevent this repeated venipuncture of patients, to monitor their bloods regularly. And we are now able to provide all the usual things that you would expect to be able to provide on an intensive care unit, including invasive ventilation, renal support, and inotropic support. This sort of cartoon shows you now how we run that in the isolation unit. So if you imagine this red box as the Trexler isolator, we now use small, quite sophisticated, not this Oxylog, but we've got a much better one now, ventilators completely inside the tent. Even though Ebola virus is not known to be transmitted by an airborne route, we like to keep everything inside the tent from a safety perspective. So the ventilator is inside the tent, venting through the negative pressure system of the tent. Everything with fluid in, so the pressure bags containing fluid for invasive lines, and all of the drugs attached to invasive catheters, all inside the tent in case there's any disconnection and flow back of blood during the process. So only recently we've been able to offer renal replacement therapy. As you saw from the picture, there wouldn't really be the space to get a hemofiltration machine inside the tent. And we had a kind of eureka moment halfway through one of the admissions, which was that we would build a small tent entirely for the hemofiltration machine. So basically we got the company in who makes our Trexler tent, and they built for us a mini Trexler tent which the hemofiltration machine goes inside. The nurses had a great deal of input designing the access ports so that you could work the machine easily. And then this small tent is connected to the larger tent by a sleeve system. So even if there was a complete failure and blood was sort of splattered outside of the device, it would all be contained completely within an isolation system. So I'll finish with what I was supposed to talk about, which is how you can prepare for patients with highly contagious diseases. And as I sort of alluded to at the beginning, in the case of viral hemorrhagic fever, that's fairly simple. What you do need at the establishment that you work in are very clear, written, and well-rehearsed plans for the unexpected patient in the emergency department, though. The next patient with viral hemorrhagic fever in this country may walk into your A&E department, and you need to be prepared for it. From what we have learnt over the last 18 months, 2 years from Ebola virus disease, all of these guidelines are currently being rewritten, so they're much simpler. They get a lot of questions about what PPE should I wear in my A&E department, etc., etc. And this will all become very clear in the new year when the new guidelines come out. I cannot stress enough the safety of the staff caring for these patients. The main mantra in our unit is basically we don't attempt to do anything unless we can 100% assure the safety of our staff. Even if that means the patient will come to some harm or die, it's more important that our staff are kept safe. rapid confirmation of diagnosis is important, and what you probably noticed was during the Ebola outbreak, more and more centres in the UK were set up so that Porton Down wasn't the only centre in the country which was able to give you a positive diagnosis. So now there are local centres around the UK which can give you a rapid diagnosis of Ebola virus disease so that you can then arrange for a transfer team to collect your patient and deliver them to us. Thank you very much indeed.
Question and answer session. Does Paul, do you want to come up as well, or are you going to talk from the lights?
No.
So Paul's been running the Twitter feed and taking note of that. I'm going to try and use some of the Twitter to ask questions. So first of all, is there anything sort of headline in the Twitter that we'd like to sort of start off with?
So Alex would like to know what the long-term delay of the Ebola patients are.
I can talk about that. So. We don't know for certain yet, but a lot of Ebola patients seem to have Ebola virus living in immune privileged sites like the eye or the testes. So there are some people who are able to transmit Ebola to their sexual partners for at least 6 months afterwards. And there are lots of reports from Africa of people having ongoing eye problems. There also are a few patients around who have had reactivation of Ebola in the form of meningitis. Some of those patients have not yet been reported in the literature, but the doctors out in Sierra Leone have got several patients that they haven't reported. It's a bit difficult to understand why they haven't all been formally reported in the literature. So obviously, some of those cases will have implications for how you treat an Ebola survivor if you see them presenting with symptoms.
Are there any questions from the floor at all? There's one at the back there. Paul.
Hello. That was a very interesting talk, especially the last one, seeing how it worked within the UK. I just wondered, is there a contingency plan for if more than two people in the UK need treatment for Ebola or something requiring level three care? For instance, you know, the impacts on other ITUs, trying to picture how you would try and do the best you could in a local unit and the implications that would have on allocation of a scarce resource to other patient groups.
I think Dan probably can answer that.
During the outbreak, there was basically what they called a surge plan, and if our isolation unit was full, so that's two patients, then they would reactivate the other isolation units around the country, which was Newcastle, Sheffield and Liverpool. So the maximum capacity for the UK during that outbreak was eight patients, which you might think is a bit worrying, but it's clearly very difficult to always plan for an epidemic in this country. And I think if we went beyond eight patients in this country, you'd basically be entering a national emergency, and one place would have to be designated as a single centre for managing Ebola, and we would have to concentrate the patients there. I don't know whether there's an actual plan for what happens if there is more than eight patients, and we all tried not to think about that prospect in the middle of treating the patients that we had. But it's a very relevant point, because the next epidemic that comes along may not be Ebola. It may be a disease which is transmitted more easily, an airborne disease, and we do need to put a lot more thought into how we're going to deal with that as a country.
I mean, the resilience discussion with the Department of Health last winter really was around then escalating to a sort of single site to try and contain the condition in that way, but having to manage it in a more open, sort of intensive care type environment.
Absolutely.
Okay, any other questions on... Can I just ask something? I'm very in awe. I've done 25 years of intensive care as a consultant. I'm in awe of listening to what you've done, and I'm really impressed with sort of the professional way in which it's been delivered. But from a practical point of view, I'm just slightly interested. Delirium in the patient, and you know they're in a fairly stressed environment, particularly if they're in a plastic bag, as Bob Winter described it. You know, how do you have problems with that? Because, I mean, we get delirium and upset patients just trying to do things to them in the ordinary intensive care unit. How do you engage with that? Because a breakage of the Trexler unit with a patient trying to come through it or something, you know, having a bad day, how do you actually do that?
It is a
a big drawback of the Trexler system, and you're right that agitation and delirium is a big problem with these patients. We've had to come up with some fairly ingenious ways of sedating people, and the degree of sedation which you would definitely not tolerate on a normal ward and would rarely even tolerate in an intensive care unit, knowing that your only option then is to ventilate these patients. Like, as Dominic described, moving up a sort of level to ventilate someone if you don't have to is a huge step to take. So it is difficult. One of our previous patients with a different viral hemorrhagic fever was a sturdy chap from the Special Forces, and he became wild inside the Trexler, and that was very, very difficult to deal with. We keep a selection of handy drugs already drawn up inside the Trexler, so if there's an emergency, we can sedate someone very rapidly and then manage their airway after that. But it is a very challenging environment from that
just
aspect.
Just one last thing. Dominic and Dan, perhaps together, could you just discuss about the pros and cons of non-invasive ventilation versus securing the airway and the sort of...
For us, like in the UK, it was always paramount that staff is first, safety of staff is first. And we also discussed about issues of performing CPR on these patients. But when it came to the point where we had to make a decision for non-invasive ventilation versus inventive ventilation, we pretty much were sure, and it was clear within the team that at that point, we did not want to go this step. To be honest, we had plans to do so. At that point, we had no video laryngoscope. We got one during this outbreak because we thought it might be needed. Colleagues in Frankfurt, which also took care for one patient, they were in need for intubation and mechanical ventilation. They performed it. They also succeeded. It took them a few weeks longer. They also put him on renal replacement therapy, which is a big problem for decontamination of the fluids. They've done a tremendous job on this.
There was anything else?
There's a few questions on the PPE and how Dominic's having positive pressure suits. The original guidelines of the Department of Health were fairly broad, and certainly in lots of trusts there was a lot of confusion amongst the nursing staff and concern. What were your thoughts on this?
I think we have to, or at least in Germany, we have to differentiate between the emergency room and the first contact. You have to easy to perform clear guidelines for the staff working there to protect themselves, which is face mask and appropriate filter and so on. And when it comes to treatment of the patient, I guess in Germany we rely on these positive pressure suits because if you look at the epidemic situation, I guess most of the healthcare personnel got infected during doing off the PPE. And this is performed quite easy in a positive pressure suit. You just go showering, 20 minutes, and afterwards it's clean. You have to train to work within this, and it's also physically demanding. You lose a lot of water in your four-hour shift. It's not similar to the tropical areas, but about 1.5, 2 liters within your shift. But we feel more confident in working in these suits than using the other lighter equipment, which is safe for dealing with the patient, but it's more difficult when you are leaving the area.
So Andy was going to just talk about your experience.
I've just got back from Sierra Leone. The World Health Organization are revising their PPE guidelines just now. But the PPE that's used in Africa now is predominantly Tyvek or similar suits, with visors, face masks, and some of the Ebola treatment centres in Sierra Leone have had no staff infections despite using relatively basic PPE and without the facility to shower after they come out. So you can do it with fairly basic PPE. A lot of it's down to careful doffing of the suits and hand washing.
Some Frontier had gone for quite a significant period of history without infecting their staff.
But they had a very small team of experts who went into the outbreaks. That doesn't work when you've got a very large outbreak.
All right, there was someone
Thank you. There seems to be a bit of a balance to be struck between having nice, clear, simple public health messaging, like you can't be infectious if you haven't got a fever, once you've recovered you can't pass it on, and so on, with obviously the more nuanced reality of disease. How did people find broaching those topics in such a sort of controversial and public interest area?
It's quite difficult, particularly in Africa, if you stigmatise survivors. They already have a stigma from having had Ebola. And in many parts of Africa, people still do not uniformly believe that Ebola exists. Sierra Leone, the Ebola epidemic started in an area that was traditionally not friendly to the government. So when government troops started appearing, taking people to Ebola treatment centres where many of them would die, the public thought this was some kind of extermination plan by the government rather than a real disease. So that it's very difficult. And I think we still don't know whether there are people who are asymptomatic spreaders and various other things like that. That's probably only going to come out once the sequencing of the virus happens in Sierra Leone and we look at the kind of taxonomic tree of the virus to see where people have got their infection from and how it's spread.
Google claimed that they knew there was Ebola before the World Health Organization based on their monitoring activity. And it took a while before sort of the UK and America really threw a lot of resource at it, and whether it was whether it was up to us to do that or not. Do you think if there's another outbreak, the world reaction will be a lot faster, or do you think the things that have been put in place in the country will be expected to cope sort of in the same way they did before?
I think that's quite difficult. There's a lot of viruses out there that we don't have vaccines for. And the vaccines for Ebola and the various drugs, a lot of them were from biological warfare defense programs and had never got anywhere because the people that would get Ebola don't have any money, and there's no money in these kind of things. But you'd hope that will now be a vaccine for SARS being made and various other infections that we're worried about.
But in terms of actually just throwing physical resource, because you said how relatively quickly it sort of came under control once there was enough resource there.
But I think some of that may have been due to luck. And if you look at the shanty town, the slums of Freetown, it's incredible to me that there weren't a lot more cases. And you remember the original predictions were of potentially more than a million infections. I think we dodged a bullet.
One last question?
Thanks for three very, very interesting talks. I think locally there was no planning until one of my colleagues pulled the hand grenade, which I thought was interesting. But then the plan was, our plan if we had someone presenting with Ebola virus disease locally was that they would be moved up to our ITU. We have an isolation room, Dan was saying at the end was quite interesting that, you know, in terms of your priority is actually protecting your own healthcare workers rather than starting potentially advanced levels of support like putting in central venous lines. It sounds like that really is not something you want to be doing in ITU. Just clearly it creates a huge ethical question about how much you would actually do in a DGH environment before you had the ability to transfer someone out and get them retrieved by your unit.
I think the best level of planning at the time for that was that these patients should remain in the emergency department, because once you start moving around the hospital, then the potential for spreading the disease around the hospital is huge. There was this very difficult question was raised during the height of it all, which is what do you do with the patient who you genuinely believe might have a viral hemorrhagic fever, but you have to wait 6-12 hours for a diagnosis and they're rapidly deteriorating. And then people would sort of make that scenario even more complicated by saying, what if it was a pregnant woman and she'd gone into labour? Would you deny her a cesarean section? And more scenarios kept being created, to the sort of the what ifs, and they are very, very challenging situations. And one of the things that was identified as that would really make a difference was that lag time in getting the diagnosis. So now there are these local reference laboratories and much faster techniques for getting a positive or a negative. You shouldn't have to wait the sort of 12, 24 hours that it used to be, sort of nervously doing nothing until you can confirm one way or the other. But I still think that that group of patients where you've not yet reached a diagnosis and they're deteriorating, that's a very difficult situation, and I don't know what the right answer for it is.
No, I mean, I think there was quite a degree of hysteria around that, those thought processes, obviously. Mm. And in a way, certainly the debate I was involved with nationally, the presentation of Ebola was not quite as we imagined,
no.
I think. So there was time for that patient. But when you translate then to the sort of SARS problem in Canada, where you get sucked in very quickly into the resuscitation of the patient, and already you've committed and put at risk your staff, and it's that balance of the disease process you're actually dealing with. You know, if, like you said, we dodged the bullet probably to some extent.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I think we'll wind that session up. I think that's been really brilliant. For me, personally, it's put to bed a few things. I understand everything a little bit better now and understood what went on. So thank you very much for your time.